Ever wondered what it's like to be a badger? Try living in a hole in the ground and eating worms.
When you put a worm into your mouth, it senses the heat as something sinister. You'd have thought it might make a bid for freedom by going down into the deeper darkness that usually means home and safety and head for your esophagus. But it doesn't. It goes for the gaps between your teeth. It thrashes, whirling one end like a centrifuge around the middle of its body. It lashes your gums. Eventually, frustrated, it curls up in the moist space next to the frenulum and considers its position. If you open your mouth again, it'll be off, pressing its tail against the floor of your mouth like a sprinter pushing off from the blocks. This is all disgusting. When you bite into a worm for the first time, you expect the sort of performance that every angler knows, twisting, questing against the hook. But it doesn't happen. Even if, like me, you can't bring yourself to mash the worm with your molars and instead nip it genteelly with your incisors, the main action is crushing. And that seems to be different. Crushed animals just lie. It doesn't seem to hurt. Anyway, both ends of the worm capitulate. And then I can move the worm back and chew it.
This is from one of the most remarkable books of the year, Being a Beast, by the British naturalist Charles Foster. Eating worms, it turns out, is what you do if you are trying to live like a badger, along with digging a hole in the ground and getting in it. Steve Paulson was deeply intrigued, and thank goodness he asked what we are all wondering.
So what did the worm taste like?
Worms taste of the land, unsurprisingly. And they vary according to, as the wine people would say, the terroir.
You mean worms from different areas will taste different?
Yeah, it's unsurprising. They take in earth into their bodies and take the bacteria off those particles. And so you'd expect them to taste of the earth. And so they do. And their slime seems to taste rather different from the body itself, mysteriously, and changes with the seasons.
Now, most people who did something like this would have a really strong visceral reaction of disgust. And, you know, it would be really hard, frankly, for a lot of people not to throw up. Did you have to deal with that kind of thing?
Of course. Yeah, I don't like doing this, but it was more interesting than it was disgusting. Because I had no idea what the land tasted like, and I rather want to know what the land that I walk over tastes like.
So Charles, I mean, the larger project is to try to become like an animal, various different kinds of animals. And so for the badger, you went to the point of, you know, digging a big burrow in the ground. You slept there for weeks on end. In fact, you took along your 8-year-old son. What were you trying to figure out here?
Well, I disagree with your description of what I was trying to do.
Okay.
I wasn't trying to be any of these animals. There's a big mistake. There are many mistakes in the book, but there's one big mistake, and it comes right at the beginning. The first line of the book is, I want to know what it's like to be a wild thing. In fact, I don't know anything other than what it's like to be a wild thing, because you and I, however polite and however metropolitan we are all wild things. We've been shaped in the course of our evolution by wild influences. And why do we like sitting by a fire at Christmas time? It's not because we have romantic Dickensian ideas or are smelling the roast chestnuts. It's because at some level of our subconscious, we feel more secure knowing that we can take a brand out of the fire and shove it into the face of the wolf which we're expecting to come. So we are all wild things. So what was I trying to do? I was trying to acknowledge those wild influences on me, and I was trying to see the landscapes that I love in the way that the creatures that know that landscape much more intimately than I do perceive it. Normally when I go into a wood, for example, I don't see the wood properly and I don't hear what's going on because of all the cognitive tinnitus which is buzzing in my head.
Right. I mean, sometimes, I mean, for instance, going back to the badger, I mean, what you did when you're in the your own burrow, your sort of badger-like hole, is you're there in the darkness. The most dominant sense that we have, vision, is sort of inoperable at that point. You got to do some other things then.
Right. And you didn't even have to be in the burrow to realize that a badger's vision is relatively unimportant to it. If you just drop the 6 feet from your usual level of seeing the world and the 30 million years down to the time when we last shared evolutionary ancestors with the badger, you will find yourself on the floor of the wood and your eyes will be pretty useless. So you will immediately need to engage senses other than your eyes. senses like olfaction, senses like hearing, senses which we have in a perfectly satisfactory way, but which we dismally underuse. So we are pathetically under-sensual creatures. We normally use only our vision, and we translate what we see into abstraction. So normally when I'm going through that wood, I'm describing not what the wood is like, but Charles Foster's thoughts about the wood, which are hugely less interesting than what the wood is really like. And I think that's a criticism which applies to lots of nature writing, which is essentially colonial. We come into the wood, we stride manfully into it, and we bring into it all our preconceptions about what that wood should be like. And when we write our nature books, we're describing the contents of our own heads. Very, very boring.
Yes, but can you really do anything else? I mean, when you get right down to it.
You can take steps to do a little bit better. Just sniff and feel, just like children do. I watch my children playing, and you could be forgiven for thinking that humans aren't meant to be bipeds because they're constantly on their hands and knees, physically pushing a lot more of their flesh against the ground than I do when I stride across the world. And they sniff and they hear that they've lost so much less than I have in their contact with the world.
Well, and I got the sense, I mean, reading your chapter on being a badger, or being sort of somewhat like a badger, that, you know, you were there with your son Tom, who was 8 at the time, and
right.
he seemed to be a better badger than you.
Hugely better, and therefore a much better perceiver of the wood. So he saw the wood much more accurately than I do. He doesn't have all those distorting lenses on when he looks at the wood.
So tell me a little bit about sort of the other senses that kicked in for you. I mean, for instance, smell. I mean, did you develop a more acute sense of smell?
I don't think I developed a more acute sense of smell. I think I became better at paying attention to smell. So our sense of smell is really pretty good. You know, quite a high proportion of us can, for example, detect our own worn T-shirt amongst other worn T-shirts that are presented to us. So just as in all other areas of life, as soon as we start paying attention to things, we notice them. Why are we satisfied as humans with simply being visual animals, with subjecting ourselves to the tyranny of the cognitive? It's just less satisfactory than acting as a human on all the cylinders that we have. Mm-hmm. So why just be a visual animal if you can be an olfactory one and an auditory one as well? It's not being less human to try to use all your, if you want to put it like this, God-given faculties. It's being more human. I just want to challenge us to use all the apparatus at our disposal.
Now, there are some kind of big philosophical questions that you are exploring here. One of them is whether we can really get into the head of another animal. Can we cross that divide between species, you know, that otherness? Because a lot of people say it's impossible. And there's a famous essay by the philosopher Thomas Nagel, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And he concluded, we will never know. What do
right.
you think?
I don't think the sort of exercise that I undertook tells you anything at all about animal minds. I think it tells you something about landscape, and I think it tells you something about yourself. So it teaches you something about the relationships with the wild that shaped you. I think you can learn to be a more intelligently self-comprehended human from crawling around in a wood or rummaging through a dustbin if you're trying to be an urban fox. But I don't think it tells you anything really about animal minds.
Yeah. Now, we've talked about your efforts to kind of be badger-like. There is another animal that would seem to be so far from what it means to be human that you couldn't even imagine sort of being anything like it, and that's the swift.
Right.
You know, the bird that can apparently stay in the air without ever touching ground for 3 or 4 years. I mean, to the point, you know, they eat, they mate, they sleep in the air for years on end.
Right. So the swifts which hatch in the eaves above my study in Oxford will go perhaps 4 times to the centre of Africa, to the Congo, without touching anything more solid than the carapace of an airborne beetle in all that time. They won't perch. As you say, they will sleep by spiraling up in the thermals. Yeah, they are part of the air. They graze on these shoals of aerial plankton, which are which are carried up from the ground. And the attempt to become one of them is ridiculous, almost blasphemous thing to suggest. So, as in the case of all these animals, now, I wasn't trying to become them, but I was trying to see the world as they see them.
So how do you attempt to try to see the world from the Swift's point of view?
Well, you can try various things, paragliding, climbing to the top of trees, where at the top of which, or around the tops of which, the Swifts are feeding. You can try, as I did, to map the swirls of air which are carrying all the insects up from the forest floor. You can try, as I did, manically following the Swifts on their migration across Europe and into West Africa. But all those things really just remind you of what a lumpen, earthbound creature you are. You know, the buckles tug at your crotch. you're fearful of falling off the top of the tree. They just remind you of the massive gulf between you and this piece of air with wings, which a swift really is. So it became a more poetical exercise, really, than anything else.
Charles Foster's book is called Being a Beast, Adventures Across the Species Divide. He talked with Steve Paulson.